From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and I wanted to make a few comments on the JFK assassination. 50 years is coming up like a speeding bullet, and all of a sudden, all the media everywhere, radio and television, magazines, newspapers, they're doing their regular hindsight, looking back 50 years to the JFK assassination. The interesting thing about this, in my opinion, well, it's actually two things. One thing is political. Let me mention that first. The JFK assassination and the theories, the hypothesis that it was a cover-up, is one thing that really crosses political lines. You end up getting lots of conservative Republicans and lots of liberal Democrats on the same page. You know, it's not unusual. 61%, according to a survey taken last week, still think that the JFK assassination was a cover-up done by more than one person, not just Lee Harvey Oswald, or maybe not even Lee Harvey Oswald at all. It's according to who you ask. But 61% is a pretty good percentage, especially 50 years later, when the establishment has had all these years to cover their tracks and try to get things in order. Of course, the problem, as we know, and we've been doing these series of shows, is that it's a nightmare when it comes to credibility. I mean, first of all, you got the autopsy, the photographs are being burned in the fireplace of the naval doctor who did it. Is saying basically that he didn't want to get the hypothesis going by the people who believe that there was something going on besides the official story. In other words, he was saying that he destroyed the evidence to protect the evidence. Sound familiar? Somewhat like government talk several times. A language that only doublespeak in America is practiced by bureaucrats. Now, when we talk about the JFK assassination, I find it incredible that even though, for instance, in this show, we're going to feature some comments by Bob Cheever and others on CBS News, even by the comments that lay open the case that maybe we didn't get the real story, we have Bob Cheever here saying, well, he believes Lee Harvey Oswald did it. He was a lone gunman. Why do I believe that? It's an interesting theory that I have, and I'm going to present it to you, and you can either throw it out the window or mull on it, or, as we say, chew on it. But when we talk about the different theories, you got to remember Bob Cheever is a member of the CBS News establishment, even though he's a great reporter, and I admire him quite a lot. And then a little earlier this year, we talked a little bit about the fact that Jim Lehrer on PBS, he believes that there was a lone gunman, and it was Lee Harvey Oswald as well. Well, I want to present something to you that you may not have thought about. Bob Cheever and Jim Lehrer, both are highly respected journalists, but they, guess what? They're both from Texas, and not from just the state of Texas. They're from right where it happened, where the dirty mark against Dallas was presented in the case for the assassination of JFK. And even though Lee Harvey Oswald was as far from being a right-winger as you can get, there were many people in Dallas that were quite respected, including H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison of the Dallas Cowboys, and many others who evidently had something to do with it. They were over at Clint Murchison's house the night before the assassination. Lyndon Johnson shows up there, and all of a sudden everybody's quiet. It's like a church mouse. And nobody's making any noise. And then as soon as Lyndon leaves, all heck breaks loose again, and the party begins again. So what was the party about? What was happening here? We only have circumstantial evidence. Most of the people by now have gone on to meet the maker, and the graveyard is full of those people. But the fact is that they left behind a legacy, and the legacy was something that was hard to live down for Dallas. First of all, Dallas was a right-wing bed of hyperbole, and some of it even got a little past that. And we're talking about 50 years ago, and I guess nothing's changed, huh? If you stop and look at the Dallas of today and how they treat Obama. The fact is that these two reporters, Jim Lehrer and Bob Cooper, are well-respected men. I'm not accusing them of anything other than perhaps a hidden bias that they don't even recommend or recognize, and that is a fact. That they're from Dallas, from that area, from Fort Worth, and they don't appreciate all of the innuendos that were happening at the time. And remember, I was in San Francisco during this event, and out there, most people were convinced that Dallas, Texas, was a hotbed of right-wing fanatical reactionaries, and that they were guilty of murder of the president. And this really hasn't changed in over 50 years. So listen to this interview and this roundtable discussion, and I think you'll find that, first of all, some incredible stuff that Bob Cheever's dug up, thanks to CBS News. He is able to come up with some pretty good witnesses. Plus, thanks to the idea that he was there on the scene as a reporter, which was the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and knew where the other reporters were and what they really thought. And we give Bob Cooper five stars for bringing all this facts forward, but I give him two stars or one star, and the same as I did James Jim Lehrer, when you talk about objectivity. There has to be something wrong when they just overlook blandly facts that are coming to light that show that the Warren Commission was dysfunctional, that we didn't get the information correct, nobody got the information correct, nobody made an effort to cover it up because it was covered up naturally by the people that were involved. And so you take all this into account and listen to this interview, and remember, I respect Bob Cheever, and I respect the job that CBS News is doing, but when they say that the evidence is there that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, I don't know what evidence they're looking at. All the evidence I've seen shows that there must have been something else going on. And we have over 100 books written by 100 researchers. Not all of them are just efforts to cash in on a big-time story with some stretching of the facts. Some of them are pretty good, objective reports. And so I submit to you, listen to this with a jaundiced eye, or in this case, a jaundiced ear, as you listen to these reporters trying to rationalize, and they did fairly successfully, that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. We weren't fed a line of you-know-what and by the authorities, and that we got the story correctly. Well, I submit to you that we didn't get the story correctly at all. We're about 180 degrees wrong. And if you want to find out what I really think about it, go over to jerrypippin.com, click on the JFK banner on the Conspiracy Files, and you can hear several shows that I've done about it over the years. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for considering my side of the story. And now let's listen to the mainstream story. And everybody should be proud of Bob Schieffer here, as he did the mainstream up well.
Arrived in Argentina in 1983 to cover the war with Great Britain over the Falkland Islands. I was told Argentina had no reliable history. Each of the country's leaders had rewritten history to play up his accomplishments and play down or eliminate whatever his predecessor had accomplished, a frequent habit of totalitarian leaders. In the days after Oswald shot the president, the first reaction of many in Dallas was to bulldoze this building as if that might somehow erase the whole thing and the fact that it had happened here. Instead, community leaders decided to make it into a museum and a center for scholarship about one of America's most terrible weekends. They recognize that a democracy requires an accurate history, without which we cannot understand how we came to be what we are. There had been threats of demonstrations and even violence from scattered right-wing hate groups before Kennedy came to Dallas, but his reception in every city, including Dallas, was overwhelmingly friendly. The man who shot him was anything but a right-wing zealot. He was an itinerant loner, a loser, and a failure who had defected to the Soviet Union. He was not from Dallas or of Dallas. Yet for years, in the minds of many, it was somehow Dallas's fault. It was not. And the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza has helped us understand that. We may never understand why Oswald did it, but the assassination could have happened in any city in America. Back in a minute.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. Joining us now, Thurston Clark, the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, CBS News contributor Douglas Brinkley, and the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, Larry Sabato. Doug Brinkley, beyond this tragedy, why was this such an important anniversary for America?
Well, I think a lot of people are remembering where they were, what I did that day. This was brought to us live on television. You were playing clips of Walter Cronkite while everybody was turning into Cronkite. What's going on? Not just John F. Kennedy died, but who did it? Then who is Lee Harvey Oswald? Who's Jack Ruby? Why is Jackie Kennedy still wearing a pink Chanel suit with blood? Where's Lyndon Johnson? On and on and on. For 4 days, everybody kind of tuned in. And there's a line by Bob Dylan who once said, people don't live or die, people just float. Most people live pretty flatline lives, but when Kennedy was killed, they weren't floating anymore. It was like real-time adrenaline for the whole country.
And, you know, I mean, those of us who were here and covered this story, I think the part that is not really understood today is that beyond this tragedy that we saw unfolding on television, and we'd never seen anything like this before, hanging over all this, it was like we all felt on 9/11. We didn't know what it meant. We didn't know if this was the beginning of World War III. We were a year away from the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was just this profound, I can't understand this. Why is this happening? And I think, in a sense, that America was never quite the same as it was after that day. Thurston Clark, your book focuses so much on Kennedy's last 100 days. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that period was so important?
Because finally, in that period, he was addressing the two great threats to our nation, a nuclear war and racial conflict. You know, at the inauguration, Robert Frost wrote a poem that he couldn't deliver because of the glare from the sun. The last words were, a golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour. There was poetry in Kennedy's first 2 years, but he didn't marry poetry to power until finally, in June, he gave two very important speeches. The first, American University speech, proposing a test ban treaty. The second, speech about race, in which he announced he was finally sending a civil rights bill to Congress.
Yeah, because race had not been all that important to him, or at least publicly. He did not mention it in his inauguration address. He was against James Meredith enrolling at Ole Miss. Yeah. He urged him not to do it. He was against the March on Washington, sponsored by Martin Luther King.
He was originally against it because the march was going to be at the Capitol, and he was afraid it would make it seem as if they were trying to intimidate Congress. So he and Bobby Kennedy were, through negotiations, they moved it down to the Lincoln Memorial. But what you said is right. Kennedy was very disappointing to the civil rights leaders on civil rights. But when he gave this marvelous speech on the 11th, at that time, Martin Luther King turned to a companion and said, "Can you believe that white man not only stood up to the plate, he hit it over the ballpark, out of the ballpark."
And Larry, one of the nuggets in your new book that I found so interesting, the story of how Jackie Kennedy called the Civil War historian James Robertson the night of the assassination to ask for help putting together her husband's funeral.
Bob, it really impressed me enormously when I first heard this, and I decided to stress it in the Kennedy Half Century because I think one of the less well-known stories and less told stories is how Jackie Kennedy helped the country get through this, and somehow in the midst of her shock and grief, even on the flight back from Dallas, she was already planning to have a Lincoln-esque funeral for her husband and to create the myth of Camelot. She was thinking about his legacy. When she was told about Lee Harvey Oswald, she said he didn't even have the opportunity to die for civil rights. It had to be some silly little communist. She wanted to convert his legacy into something bigger, and she did.
But she actually tried to replicate in the White House how it had looked when Lincoln's casket had brought
that. Yes, that historian was called by the White House and told to go over to the Library of Congress and get all the information he could about Lincoln's funeral. The first thing he said was, "In the meantime, you get all the black bunting you can find." He went over to the Library of Congress. They didn't have the lights on. They couldn't find the light switches. They used flashlights, and they found old Harper's Weekly from 1865. He dashed over to the White House. He got there in a sea of black bunting with a team of carpenters already ready to construct the Lincoln East Room affair, just as it had been in 1865.
And Doug, you, of course, wrote the wronderful biography of Walter Cronkite. This was a day that not only changed the country, it changed television. It changed the way we get information. Up until this point, most people got their news from print.
Absolutely.
And this, nothing like this had ever happened before.
No, in the 50s, you had the Kefauver, you know, hearings being brought on TV. Well, that's just Congress's sausage making. And certainly John Glenn's Triple Orbit started bringing people into special effects television. But bringing a real-life trauma like this hour after hour after hour, with all those poignant moments, including the young Kennedy children there at Arlington National Cemetery and Jackie Kennedy looking so almost Madonna-like, or almost that every time you see that photo of her with the veil, it's just the most gripping drama. And as you mentioned, after that, Vietnam becomes the television war, and Watergate's brought on TV, and we're all turned into these big events and follow them through. The Kennedy assassination began that.
As horrible as it was, I mean, I think what it hit people even harder because they had come to believe, did they not, Thurston, that they knew the Kennedys better than they'd known any of his predecessors simply because of television.
Well, exactly. And Kennedy gave a live televised news conference on average every 16 days. It's extraordinary now if you compare it to what's happened since. You know, the other thing is that again and again you read people saying, "I knew him as if he was my brother, as if he was my son." Charles de Gaulle said afterwards, "They're crying all over France as if he was a Frenchman, a member of their families." I mean, de Gaulle was stunned by this reaction.
And he was, and still, in my view, was the best there ever was at television and knowing how to use it and how to communicate on television.
All presidents try to imitate John F. Kennedy, but they can't. He had a special magic, a special combination of rhetorical ability, the ability to inspire, and also self-deprecating humor, which some of our presidents really ought to acquire.
But you know, the interesting thing is he didn't like television that much. When he came to the White House, he had all of the sets pulled out, and he left one with rabbit ears so Caroline could watch Lassie.
I must say, I never knew that. Why do you think it is, and I'll put the question to all three of you, today 61% of the American people still believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. I think the evidence is overwhelming that he did. I've always tried to keep an open mind about these various conspiracy theories, but it, as yet, no one has shown me evidence to convince me that there was anybody else connected. Why do you think that is, Larry?
People looked at this as one of the most terrible things that had ever happened in American history, and it was. It was so big. How could you balance it with a loser, a total loser, who had failed at everything, as Lee Harvey Oswald had? There had to be more meaning in it, and they've tried to invest it with meaning by saying, it's the CIA, it's the anti-Castro Cubans, it's LBJ, it's this one, it's that one. But as you say, you have to go by the evidence, and we're still waiting for evidence beyond that of Lee Harvey Oswald, who clearly was guilty.
Well, there's no question that the administration was using every means they could. They wanted to kill Castro, and they were sending sabotage missions in there. Castro knew about that. But again, there is no evidence that he ever acted on it. And in fact, he later said in an interview, I would always want a second source when I hear something from Castro. But he said, I'm smarter than that, basically. He said they would have obliterated this island if I had done something like that.
Look, it's clear Lee Harvey Oswald killed John F. Kennedy. And you ask why people wonder. I interviewed Gerald Ford at Rancho Mirage once for a book, and I was asking about NATO and the fall of Saigon and his presidency. And he said, come here. He said, look at this. And it was a little stack like this. He said, this is my incoming about my presidency. Now, you see this stack? It was like towering. He said, that was about me and the Warren Commission and why I invented a magic bullet. And, you know, I think it gets down to the Warren Commission report. I think it was in time sloppy. It was rushed. But it was right in the end. And maybe on this 50th anniversary, we need to thank people, the legacies of Gerald Ford and John McCloy and Erland Specter and people that worked so hard on those multiple volumes, because they, I think, nailed the story.
What do you think, Thurston, that John Kennedy's real legacy is?
Oh, first of all, that he was the first Catholic elected president. I mean, he kicked open the door. After him came a whole bunch of other minorities. He appointed the first Polish American to his cabinet, John Grunowski. He wrote a book about immigration called A Nation of Immigrants. Very important to him. The other is, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. If Kennedy hadn't been president, I don't wonder if we'd be sitting here right now, if there'd be a Dallas. I mean, his role in that was absolutely crucial. And he realized it, too, afterwards at a press conference. He'd been the only one who didn't want to have a retaliatory strike. At a press conference afterwards, he refers to Abraham Lincoln, asks his cabinet to vote. Lincoln's cabinet, they say 12 ayes. Lincoln says, I vote nay. The nays win. That had to be on his mind.
Thank you all very much on this very special weekend in American history. We'll be back in 1 minute. Hugh Ainsworth, who covered the assassination for the Dallas Morning News, he has a new book out called November 22nd, 1963, Witness to History. Mike Cochran, who covered it for the Associated Press here in Dallas and in Fort Worth. And Dr. Ronald Jones, now head of the surgery at Baylor University. He back then was chief surgical resident at Parkland Hospital. Hugh, I want to start with you because you were one of the few people who saw President Kennedy being shot. You later were there when Lee Harvey Oswald was shot, and you also were there when Lee Harvey Oswald was captured at the Texas Theater. What was this like when these shots rang out? You were just not far from where we are right now in Dealey Plaza.
Within seconds, it was complete pandemonium. People were throwing their children down, protecting them. People were running into each other. People were screaming and crying. It was just the most hectic thing you could imagine.
And it was such a contrast because people had been so happy at all this. Mike Cochran, you were the AP guy in Fort Worth. You worked out of the newsroom of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram where I was a reporter. It had gone very well in Fort Worth.
Oh, it had gone beautifully. The people of Fort Worth, the welcome, it was just amazing. They obviously adored the president and Jacqueline. And it was really heartwarming. And it was the people at the Hotel Texas, both outside and inside, were just seemed to be beside themselves. And it was really quite a moving episode.
Well, I remember the reporters who were there and covered him, and you were there. You were kind of relieved when the story moved to Dallas.
Yes, I. left the Hotel Texas and went to Carswell and phoned what was the final wheels up bulletin for President Kennedy when the plane took off for the short hop to Dallas. I walked back, when I got back to the office, I walked through the newsroom of the Star-Telegram, and as I passed the news desk, I kind of stopped and quipped, and I said, "Well, we got him out of town safely." Went into my office. I sat down at my desk, and just minutes later, a copy boy screamed and torn some copy off the Associated Press printer, and he screamed, "The president's been shot."
Yeah. You know, Doctor, you were at Parkland Hospital there. We didn't know what had happened. What? How did you feel when you got word of this?
I had just finished an operative procedure that morning and gone down to the cafeteria to have lunch. And the page operator began to call people's staff, respond immediately, including the chief of surgery, who I knew was out of town. And I called the operator, and I said, "Why are you paging everyone's staff?" And she said, "Dr. Jones, the president's been shot, and they're bringing him to the emergency room, and they need physicians right away." And so Dr. Perry and I ran out the back of the cafeteria, down the hall, down steps, and to the emergency room and into trauma room one. And Mrs. Kennedy was on the left of the door. As I entered, the president was on a stretcher, arms out on arm boards, and I noticed a small hole in the front of the neck that I may estimate to be about a quarter of an inch, and I knew he had a large wound in the back of his head, the extent of which I wasn't sure because we hadn't examined him that closely. And Dr. Carrico was trying to get an airway going, and Dr. Perry decided he would do a tracheotomy, and I would do a cut down in the upper arm.
And he was alive at that point, but just barely.
Dr. Carrico thought he had seen some attempts at respiration. Whether that was true or just a neurologic response, I don't know. When I saw him, he was motionless. His eyes were open. He was staring. And I never saw any evidence of life as such. But nevertheless, we decided to try to do something rather than do nothing, because occasionally you can get somebody brought back. But we didn't know the extent of that brain injury at that time.
All right. We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about what happened after that. In a minute. Now, Hugh Ainsworth, you had been there in Dealey Plaza and saw this happen, and then you were in the police station that morning when Oswald was shot. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, you know, I was somewhat concerned because there had been many death threats through the night, and when I got up and found out they had moved him, I was amazed. I grabbed my wife and I said, "We've got to get down there." So we ran like the devil for the police station. I got in just a very few minutes before they brought him out. Now, I did not see Ruby. I was probably 3 or 4 feet people behind. But all of a sudden we heard this pop, and just it was almost like being the first day 2 days later, because everyone went wild. And there were so many international reporters there. They were speaking different languages and pushing and shoving. And, you know, they had those huge cameras in those days, and everybody was getting bumped around. But it was a good while before we knew it was Ruby.
You had known Jack Ruby, did you not, or knew of him?
I had known him for about 3 years.
Why do you think he did it?
I think he wanted to be somebody. He was quite a show-off. He was not a nice man. He had a huge temper. And I'd see him at the newspaper every week, a couple of times. He was a groupie for newsmen and cops.
Mike, what happened? You were back in Fort Worth. You had no idea of coming to Dallas, did you?
Not in the beginning, but the after we heard the president had been shot, well, my wife had dropped me off after we'd gone to Carsville, so I didn't have a car, but I jumped in with a bunch of Star Telegram writers and photographers and just headed over to Parkland.
But the most amazing thing that happened to you was the burial of Lee Harvey Oswald, where you actually became a pallbearer, as it were, in that funeral, you and three reporters from the Star Telegram. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it was at Rose Hill Cemetery in Fort Worth, and of course I was based in Fort Worth, and so I was assigned to cover it. We'd gotten the tip the night before. I was in Dallas, in the Dallas Bureau the night before, after Oswald had been killed. But we got a tip that there would be the funeral in Fort Worth the next day. And so when I showed up, of course, there were nobody there. I mean, we were early. They delivered the casket. The police escort delivered the casket about 1:30. But as the day went on, you know, there were no mourners there.
Yeah. And so how did it happen? The funeral home operator said somebody's got to help us get this casket out of the hearse.
Well, if we were waiting, you know, one of the strangest things, at about 3 o'clock, somewhere around 3 o'clock, a rumor started that the casket was empty. That there was nobody in that casket, and if there was anybody in that casket, it was not Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
And so it caused such a stir that the police chief, Cato Hightower, and a couple of officers went into the little chapel, checked, and came back out and assured us that at least Oswald was.
But you and the reporters carried the casket out to the gravesite.
That's right.
Doctor, let me ask you, were called back to the emergency room when they brought Lee Oswald. Was he alive when he got there?
He was alive when he got there. There were four of us that got to trauma room two, which is where Governor Connally had been, and he did have a heartbeat. And he had been shot in the left chest and had major vascular injuries. As Jack Ruby shot him, he turned like this, and that caused a lot of more of injuries than if he'd taken the shot straight on. But same thing, I did a cut down in the upper arm, just as I had in the president, and inserted a chest tube, and we had him to surgery within about 10 minutes after he came to the emergency room, and he lived almost roughly an hour and 20 minutes before he expired on the table.
But he said nothing.
He said nothing. He was unconscious, much as the president looked, but he had a heartbeat and was alive when he came to the emergency room.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll be back in a moment.
The story broke on the United Press wire. Merriman Smith had the first flash, traveling with the group going through Dealey Plaza. And when that bulletin flash came on the air, Eddie Bliss, our editor, happened to be right at the machine. I was at my desk a few feet away. And he yelled that there was shooting in Dallas. Well, right away, I run to the machine, and we start shouting to everybody else, "Hey, the Kennedy's been shot!" And right away, we hoped for television. We realized it wasn't possible. Ran into an adjoining room, and Eddie started feeding the press service bulletin to me, which I was digesting, reading on the air, and they. You know, waved me back into the news desk the minute they had the televisions hot. I saw them wheeling them into the newsroom, and they got me back. The intensity with which we were doing the job was indicated by the fact that I didn't get off the air for 5 hours, didn't leave the desk. When I did, I realized I was in shirt sleeves. Well, not long before that, Frank Stanton let the word pass that he didn't like to see his correspondents in shirt sleeves. And here I was in shirt sleeves, one of the most important broadcasts of all time. My secretary had been told to bring my jacket out. She'd put it on the back of the chair, and perhaps she'd told me it was there. But those words just passed through my head. I had far more important things to think about.
Well, during a long interview I had with Mr. Johnson at the LBJ Ranch in September 1969, We talked about the Kennedy assassination. A portion of the interview was not broadcast at the president's request on the grounds, he said, of national security. I asked Mr. Johnson then whether he was satisfied there was no international conspiracy in his assassination.
I can't honestly say that I've ever been completely relieved of the fact that there might have been international connections.
You mean you still feel that there might have been?
Well, I have not completely discounted.
Well, that would seem to indicate that you don't have full confidence in the Warren Commission report.
No, I think the Warren Commission study, and I think, first of all, is composed of the ablest, most judicious, bipartisan men in this country. Second, I think they had only one objective, and that was the truth. And third, I think they were competent and did the best they could. But I don't think that they are, me or anyone else, is always absolutely sure of every thing that might have motivated Oswald or others that could have been involved.
I think we need to listen to a lecture here by Larry Sabato, in which he details the politics and the political situation in a pretty good light. In other words, I think what he's saying rings true. So listen to Professor Larry Sabato and why LBJ did not kill JFK.
Some of the many questions that have arisen over the 50 years since President Kennedy's assassination. Look closely at the film recorded by Abraham Zapruder as the president's limousine passed through Dealey Plaza. We have slowed it down significantly for demonstration purposes. The time here is roughly 12:30 Central Standard Time, and the president's limousine is just completing the hairpin turn from Houston Street onto Elm Street, where the president was shot. President and Mrs. Kennedy are seated in the back of the convertible limousine. Seated in front of the president is Texas Governor John Connally. Seated in front of Mrs. Kennedy is Governor Connally's wife, Nellie Connally. From government and media reports, we know that Special Agent William R. Greer of the Secret Service was driving the presidential limousine. On his right sat Secret Service Agent Roy Kellerman, whose responsibilities included maintaining radio communications with the lead and follow cars, as well as scanning the route and getting out and standing near the president when the car stopped. There were four motorcycles, two on each side that flanked the rear of the presidential car. There were other motorcycle officers within the motorcade, but these four were there to provide some cover for the president and to keep back the crowd. On previous occasions, the president had requested that, to the extent possible, these flanking motorcycles keep back from the sides of his car. Immediately behind the president is the presidential follow car. This vehicle, a 1955 Cadillac 8-passenger convertible, was especially outfitted for the Secret Service. It followed closely behind the president's automobile. It carried 8 Secret Service agents, 2 in the front seat, 2 in the rear, and 2 on each of the right and left running boards. The agents in this car, under established procedure, had instructions to watch the route for signs of trouble. They were scanning not only the crowds, but the windows and roofs of buildings, overpasses, and crossings. They were instructed to watch particularly for thrown objects, for sudden actions in the crowd, for any movements toward the presidential car that could be threatening. The agents on the front of the running boards had directions to move immediately to positions just to the rear of the president and Mrs. Kennedy when the president's car slowed to a walking pace or stopped, or when the press of the crowd made it impossible for the escort motorcycles to stay in position on the car's rear flanks. The two agents on the rear of the running boards were to advance toward the front of the president's car whenever it stopped, or whenever it slowed down sufficiently for them to do so. Here is the moment of impact of the first shot that struck President Kennedy. Here is the moment of impact for the fatal headshot. To many people, the Zapruder film raises questions over whether the bullet that struck the president's head was fired from a gun that was behind him or in front of him. Notice that President Kennedy's head and upper torso are clearly thrown backward in a manner seemingly inconsistent with a shot coming from the rear. Some leading experts in physics have concluded that the recoil of the president's head proves that the fatal shot was not fired from the depository, but rather from a location in front of Kennedy's limousine. By no means is this analysis unanimously supported. Others use photographic and scientific perspectives to insist that the Zapruder film shows that the president initially fell forward, having been hit from behind. Then the jet propulsion factor took effect, pushing the president backwards. Jackie Kennedy is in shock, jumps up. It's clear that she is trying to retrieve a piece of the president's skull that has fallen on the back of the limousine, on the trunk of the limousine. But it's also very dangerous because the driver is getting ready to speed up to go to Parkland Hospital. So her Secret Service agent, Clint Hill, who was on her side of the car, is making a mad dash. He had already started to run, having realized that President Kennedy was under attack, but he was just short of the car. He was unable to prevent that bullet from striking President Kennedy's head. He was, however, able to push Mrs. Kennedy into the car, at which point Clint Hill covered the First Lady and the President with his body, trying to protect them as they went down under the overpass and on the way to Parkland Hospital, which was 5 minutes away. There were people on the other side of the overpass. They had no idea what had happened. They were waving, but of course, instead of seeing the president, they saw a foot sticking out. It was Clint Hill's foot. For a long time, people thought it was President Kennedy's, but it was actually Clint Hill's foot as he was trying to cover them and trying to make room for his body. Listen to some of the chaos, confusion, and incorrect reports that were recorded by the Dallas Police Department in the minutes surrounding the assassination.
Go to hospital. On our way. Parkland Hospital. Have him stand by. Get me on top of that underpass. See what happened up there. Go up to the overpass. Who got shot? Station 5 to move all men available out of my department back into the railroad yard there in an effort to try to determine if what and when happened down there and hold everything secure until the homicide and other investigators can get there. Looks like the president's been hit. Just talking to a guy up here at the scene of this where these shots were fired at, and he said that he was sitting here close to it, and he's coming on account of this Texas school group depository building here with that Hunt furnace on top.
Two, evidently there has been a shooting with the president involved. I do not know the seriousness of it. One is at Parkland along with Dallas One.
I have a witness to say come from the fourth floor of the Texas Depository Bookstore at Houston for building.
Book Depository Store on the corner of Elm and Field. Officers are now surrounding and searching the building, 1240.
This is the sound of Agent Willie Price, who was stationed at the Trademark, the site to which the president was traveling for his luncheon speech. He also accompanied President Johnson to Parkland Hospital, reporting over the police radio system what he saw when he reached the hospital.
The president's head was practically blown off.
The call time of his report was 12:40, but the public wouldn't hear the official news for about another hour. Upon arrival at Parkland Hospital, Governor Connally, who had fainted from shock and loss of blood, regained consciousness and was immediately helped onto a stretcher. About 1:20, the bullet was found on the stretcher by Parkland's chief engineer, Darrell Tomlinson. But later, Tomlinson was uncertain that this stretcher was the one used for Connally, and others wondered whether the bullet had been planted in order to implicate Lee Harvey Oswald. Further questions have been raised about the condition of this bullet, which was only slightly compacted at its base, despite having allegedly passed through two bodies and broken bones in Governor Connally. The ambiguous nature of the visual evidence can lead to diametrically opposite conclusions. And that was true of the only two official governmental reports that had been conducted since the assassination. Remember, in the year after the president's assassination, the Warren Commission concluded that the assassination was the result of the actions of a single person, a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. More than a decade after the Warren Commission's findings were released, another government investigation would be opened by the House Select Committee on Assassinations at the U.S. House of Representatives. This second governmental body flatly contradicted the Warren Commission by concluding that the assassination of President Kennedy was the result of a conspiracy. So which government conclusion is correct? Was the assassination really the work of just one person, or were others involved? What other person or groups of people had reason to want to murder President Kennedy? We'll discuss some of those possibilities in our next segment. Proof is often lacking to support plausible conjecture, as well as semi-reliable hearsay and logical guesswork. Unfortunately, contrary to what the experts say on TV crime shows, the same is true for some of the physical evidence. Where you stand on that evidence depends on where you sat about November 22, 1963, or thereafter. Take the medical findings and judgments of those who saw President Kennedy right after his fatal shooting. President Kennedy arrived at Parkland Hospital within a few minutes of the shooting at around 12:35. The physicians worked desperately to save the president's life, but they knew the situation was extremely grim. Doctors noted the president was having trouble breathing and had no palpable pulse. He had a large, gaping wound in the right rear part of his head with substantial damage and exposure of brain tissue and a considerable loss of blood. It was much too late for miracles. The time of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's death was somewhat arbitrarily fixed by the doctors as being 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. They cited a gunshot wound to the head as the cause of death. Assistant Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff had accompanied Kennedy and made the official announcement of the president's death to journalists gathered in the hospital. Following that, the doctors gave an impromptu press conference. The lead doctor told the press that he could not identify the entry point for the bullet, the one that had shattered the president's skull. This statement was corroborated by other doctors who said that the head wound could have been either the exit wound from the neck, or it could have been a tangential wound, as it was simply a large, gaping loss of tissue. Not long after Kennedy expired, the White House staff and Secret Service, with Mrs. Kennedy at their side, began wheeling JFK's body out of Parkland Hospital. The Dallas County Medical Examiner tried to stop them, noting that Texas law required an autopsy to be performed in Texas. He was correct, by the way. Kennedy's aides refused to comply, and armed agents stepped in to remove the president's body and transport it back to Air Force One. It is possible that some of the unending controversy about the JFK autopsy would have been resolved, or would never have occurred, had the autopsy been done in Dallas. But the official autopsy was not conducted in Texas, and many hours later, it occurred at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. The autopsy was inadequate in other ways as well. The Bethesda physicians did not confer with the Parkland medical team before they began the procedure, and they did not have the opportunity to examine the president's clothing, which was removed at Parkland Hospital. This was unfortunate, as the bullet holes in JFK's coat and shirt were critical in understanding one bullet's trajectory. On top of it all, the doctors at Bethesda felt pressure from President Kennedy's brother Robert, Mrs. Kennedy, and other White House aides to finish as quickly as possible. The family simply refused to leave the hospital until the autopsy was finished and the body was prepared to lie in state at the White House. Please see the book for more details. The National Archives and Records Administration has never released the autopsy photos to the press or public. They are, after all, fundamentally private medical records. It was completely appropriate to withhold the photos in the years immediately following JFK's death. But after a half century, this is pure American history, and it's a vital piece of the assassination puzzle. It's time to release all the medical evidence so that everyone with an interest in the case can sort out the truth from varying perspectives.
I want to take this opportunity to express my appreciation for the hundreds of thousands of messages, nearly 800,000 in all, which my children and I have received over the past few weeks. The knowledge of the affection in which my husband was held by all of you has sustained me, and the warmth of these tributes is something I shall never forget. Whenever I can bear to, I read them. All his bright light gone from the world. All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him and that he returned that love in full measure. It is my greatest wish that all of these letters be acknowledged. They will be, but it will take a long time to do so. But I know you will understand. Each and every message is to be treasured, not only for my children, but so that future generations will know how much our country and people in other nations thought of him.
Longest running sagas in American history, involving hundreds of subplots. Facts and quasi-facts have dribbled out over five decades. Quite a few of these facts are unverifiable or only partially verifiable, which does not necessarily mean they are incorrect. Stories are told by respectable and dubious witnesses alike that are based on murky memories of long ago events. Some legitimate evidence is contradictory. The cast of characters in this historical enterprise, many of them colorful and quirky, could fill a bookshelf of Shakespearean plays. The search for the truth of JFK's assassination is like the quest for El Dorado, the mythical city of gold that tantalized European explorers in the 16th century. Inspired by vague clues and Amerindian legends, these explorers spent years in the wilderness hoping to strike it rich, but often died of disease and starvation instead. This class could never cover all the details in the short time we have together. For those who are interested, my book, The Kennedy Half Century, is a synthesis of what we know after 50 years. It's not a misguided attempt to solve the insoluble or to figure out every detail of the assassination. 4 days after JFK was laid to rest in Arlington Cemetery, President Lyndon Johnson asked the Chief Justice of the United States to head a federal probe into the assassination. LBJ signed an executive order later that day that created a commission to ascertain, evaluate, and report upon the facts relating to the assassination of the late President John F. Kennedy and the subsequent violent death of the man charged with the assassination. The Earl Warren Commission, Warren Commission for short, was doomed from the start because Washington's power brokers, led by the new president himself, were far more interested in preserving domestic tranquility than in finding the full truth. They wanted a report that would first calm citizens' jangled nerves by reassuring them that a lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald had acted completely on his own. Conspiratorial chatter, so the reasoning went, would only undermine public trust in government and perhaps even lead to war if fingers were pointed at Fidel Castro or the Soviets. Just 13 months earlier, the United States had narrowly avoided a nuclear conflagration with Russia, and the Cold War was still freezing. The public was suspicious of Russia, Cuba, and more. In the immediate aftermath of the assassination, 62% of the American people believed that their president had been killed in a conspiracy. Official Washington felt the need to respond. The Warren Commission launched its investigation of the JFK assassination in February 1964. Acting on President Johnson's instructions, Earl Warren urged the commission to complete its work before July, when the presidential campaign would likely heat up. So, in effect, there was a political calendar for a murder investigation. Over the next 6 months, the commission recorded the testimony of 552 people, examined thousands of documents, and held 51 sessions. Commission members, however, skipped many of the meetings. The hard work was assigned to assistants like Arlen Specter, who invented the single bullet theory to reconcile apparently indisputable facts that emerged in the course of the Warren investigation, including the reality that Oswald or any marksman needed a certain number of seconds to fire a rifle repeatedly within the elapsed time of the shooting. Specter and his colleagues had screened the publicly unseen amateur home movie shot by businessman Abraham Zapruder in Dealey Plaza, which cast grave doubts on the validity of the FBI report. It showed Governor Connally groaning in agony less than 2 seconds after Kennedy was shot in the back. The commission realized that no marksman, however skilled, could fire 2 shots within 2 seconds from a bolt-action rifle. Specter's single-bullet theory, which asserted that the bullet striking JFK's back continued on cleanly through Kennedy's throat to cause all of Connally's many wounds, neatly solved the dilemma. Other Warren Commission staffers investigated the Jack Ruby case and concluded that Ruby had impulsively killed Oswald in a fit of pique. Other pieces of the assassination puzzle were similarly assembled into the overall pattern, some easily, others with difficulty. The time pressures guaranteed that all of the evidence could not be gathered and sifted. Many key witnesses were not even interviewed. A future U.S. president, Gerald Ford, was so anxious to close the case that he changed the description of the president's back wound so that it would simply comply with Specter's single-bullet theory. Ford would later insist that he was trying to make the report more precise. On September 24, 1964, the Warren Commission presented its final report to the President of the United States.
To the White House in Washington comes the final verdict on the fateful tragedy which engulfed the nation 10 months ago. U.S. Chief Justice Earl Warren is the bearer of the sad epilogue. The report of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, compiled by the commission created by President Johnson, which was headed by the Chief Justice himself.
Johnson released a letter of appreciation later that day. He said, "The commission, I know, has been guided throughout by a determination to find and tell the whole truth of these terrible events. This is our obligation to the good name of the United States of America and to all men everywhere who respect our nation, and above all, to the memory of President Kennedy." The Warren Commission concluded that Oswald and Ruby had committed their crimes without help or encouragement from anyone else. While some prominent journalists, such as CBS's Walter Cronkite, were privately skeptical, news organizations generally did not question the Warren Commission's findings. This was an era very different from today, when columnists and publishers were often the government's lapdogs instead of their watchdogs. In editorials, the nation's newspapers were overwhelmingly deferential to the Warren Commission. Initially, most Americans accepted the conclusions of the Warren Report. After it was released, only 31% of the public still believed that JFK had been a victim of a conspiracy, exactly half what the percentage had been in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. Ironically, in its rush to tamp down the rumors surrounding the assassination, the Warren Commission guaranteed the perpetuation of conspiracy theories for years to come. In the early 1960s, the public was thought incapable of handling the truth. Rather, it had to be spoon-fed a convenient, calming version of events. The Warren Commission gave people a sanitized, abbreviated version of the assassination. The public was condescendingly told to accept the official account without subversive, unpatriotic questioning. The commission laid the groundwork for the cynicism that became deeply rooted in the late 1960s and the 1970s. That is, a profound distrust of the official government story about anything. Instead of being viewed as authoritative, government pronouncements became mocked as deceitful propaganda from the Ministry of Truth. Chief among the failings of the Warren Commission was the fact that it did not interview significant numbers of eyewitnesses. There isn't time to detail the long list here, but you can find many of their stories within the pages of the Kennedy Half Century, including those of Bill and Gail Newman, who were in Dealey Plaza with their children when the shots rang out. H.B. McLean, a Dallas motorcycle cop who was part of the presidential motorcade. Marilyn Sitzman, who assisted her boss Abraham Zapruder in steadying himself while filming the president passing through Dealey Plaza. Elsie Dorman and Robert Croft, two amateur photographers who captured images of the president's motorcade as it drove through Dealey Plaza. Jim and Patricia Towner and their daughter Tina, who also were taking film and photos in Dealey Plaza seconds before the assassination. Mary Woodward, Maggie Brown, Aurelia Lorenzo, and Ann Donaldson all worked for the Dallas Morning News in 1963, and all of them were standing on the north curb of Elm Street during the assassination, Elm Street being the street where the assassination occurred. A.J. Milliken, who had been standing near Woodward and her colleagues, when he heard what he said were a total of 8 shots coming from various directions. Mary Moorman, who took the most famous still photograph of the moment the fatal bullet struck John Kennedy that you see here. A photo that may or may not show a man in a uniform behind the picket fence, and an apparent puff of white smoke that may or may not have been the aftermath of a gunshot. And also Victoria Adams, a young woman who watched the president die from the fourth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and said after the shots were fired, she fled down the depository's back stairwell, supposedly the same stairwell that Oswald had to use to make his escape from the sixth floor. Adams testified that she did not see or hear Oswald in that stairwell immediately after the assassination. The staff of the Warren Commission seemed to view Adams not as a vital witness, but as a threat to their preferred timeline of events, and they alternately ignored and defamed her. Had the Warren Commission enlisted Dallas police and citizens to identify more of those present in the plaza and depository while their memories were fresh, they might have secured many more reliable accounts from every perspective in the plaza that could have enabled the commission and the public to weigh the preponderance of the evidence. And it might have been able to diminish the number of individuals who turned up years later with dramatic but questionable narratives about the assassination. As one person we interviewed said, if everyone who claimed to have been in Dealey Plaza was actually there, you could fill the Rose Bowl. The glaring inadequacies of the Warren Commission do not automatically mean that the commission erred in fingering Oswald as the lone gunman. Much testimony supports the commission viewpoint. One thing is certain. Today, it is difficult to separate fact from fiction when dealing with eyewitness accounts on November 22nd. Human beings notice different things during a crisis, and they see only a small part of the whole. They also tend to confuse media reports and the stories of other eyewitnesses with what they actually saw or heard. The result is a hodgepodge of truths, half-truths, blatant falsehoods, and sensational embellishments. A fair investigation can only reach a truthful conclusion once all the relevant testimony has been considered and compared. That the Warren Commission failed to do so is obvious to any unbiased investigator in the days, weeks, and months that followed November 22nd. The trail at that time was hot. Memories were at their sharpest. The commission had the strong backing of Congress and the country. Whatever money and staff were needed to produce a thorough report would have been forthcoming had they asked. While impatient, the public would have been willing to give the investigators the time they required to produce complete answers. Instead, many critical witnesses were overlooked. Many paths were not taken. Many tips not pursued, and a political schedule, not an investigator's timetable, determined the release date of the commission report. those responsible for these decisions would say the nation needed to move on. Yet the irony of the commission's rushed and pre-digested report is that the nation was caught in a time warp for years. So instead of shutting the door on cynical and destructive assassination speculation, the Warren Commission actually maximized the opportunities for it. Countless books, television specials, newspaper articles, internet sites claim to know the precise truth about the assassination. The mafia did it. The CIA did it. No, it was anti-Castro Cubans. No, it was pro-Castro Cubans. It was Lyndon Johnson. The Secret Service did it. The Soviets were behind it. Texas oil millionaires paid for it. All of these theories have been proposed. There isn't time here. There wouldn't be time in a year-long course to cover all of the many theories that have emerged over the last 50 years. But I do want to discuss a few of the more prominent and pervasive theories that have been put forward. For a more complete list and more extensive coverage of the major theories, you need to consult the Kennedy Half Century. The suggestion that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the murder of his predecessor shocks almost anyone. But more than a few assassination researchers have put forward the theory that Lyndon Johnson was a willing co-conspirator in the killing of his predecessor, or at the very least, had prior knowledge that something was afoot. The linchpin of this conjecture is the belief that Johnson was far more amenable than JFK to the plans of the military, the defense industry, and the CIA to escalate in Vietnam. Now, Johnson lusted after the White House. That's obvious. He'd run for the Democratic nomination against Kennedy in 1960. He regarded John Kennedy as a lightweight in the Senate. He hated Robert Kennedy. That was his enemy. Their personal dislike was intense. They could barely contain it. Johnson believed that he'd been ill-treated as vice president to a certain degree, that his talents had been underutilized, that his influence had been marginalized by the Kennedy inner circle that called him Uncle Cornpone. He may even have thought that Kennedy might have dropped him from the ticket in 1964, or was going to do so. Anyone who has studied Johnson's career has got to acknowledge that for all of his intelligence and dazzling legislative and strategic skills, he was an exceptionally devious individual, and he was capable of great cruelty, even to those personally and professionally close to him. Most were quick to note that President Kennedy had been murdered in LBJ's Texas. Kennedy had gone there mainly to assist in brokering a truce in Democratic factional infighting, in which Johnson was a key player. Some friends and advisors, aware of the harsh treatment that had greeted United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson in Dallas, he had been spat upon in that city 1 month earlier, wanted Kennedy to cancel the Dallas part of the Texas trip. Johnson's ascension to ultimate power, thanks to Kennedy's death in LBJ State, seemed awfully suspicious and mighty convenient. Kennedy loyalists quickly made the obvious connections, including Evelyn Lincoln, who was JFK's personal and close White House secretary, and she made it only a couple of hours after the assassination. Mrs. Lincoln was with Kennedy in Dallas. She flew back to Washington aboard Air Force One with LBJ and the president's body. During the flight, Evelyn Lincoln compiled a list of people and groups that she thought might have been responsible for the president's death. At the very top of her list was the name Lyndon. Yet one of Johnson's comments made during the flight, reflecting his fear of a possible conspiracy involving enemies of the United States, has to cast some doubt on Lincoln's assertion. Quote, "I wonder if the missiles are flying," he told his aide, Bill Moyers, who had asked him what was on his mind. Moreover, according to a key eyewitness, General Godfrey McHugh, who was very close to President Kennedy, the new president, Lyndon Johnson, was not as calm on Air Force One as one might have hoped, at least for a time. McHugh reported that he walked in on the toilet, quote, and in the powder room, there was hiding with the curtain closed, Lyndon Johnson, saying, "They're going to get us all. It's a plot. It's a plot. It's going to get us all." He was hysterical, said General McHugh, sitting down on the John there alone in this thing. Conspiracy theorists claim they know why Johnson would have risked his career and even his life if he'd been accused of murder. By the autumn of 1963, rumors were circulating widely that LBJ would be dropped from the 1964 ticket. On the very day Kennedy died, the Dallas Morning News announced that Nixon predicts JFK may drop Johnson. That was a headline. Evelyn Lincoln also claimed years later that she had discussed with President Kennedy his 1964 vice presidential plans shortly before the Dallas trip. And Kennedy had told her, she claimed, that he had decided to drop LBJ and substitute North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford. Johnson had superb political antennae and lots of friends. So if JFK's intention was to replace him, he very possibly could have known that his days as the man a heartbeat away from the Oval Office were numbered. The problem with this scenario is there is not a shred of real evidence, the kind that would survive under competent cross-examination in a courtroom. Top Kennedy aides have insisted that the Kennedy-Johnson ticket would have been kept intact for the 1964 campaign. Jackie Kennedy also confirmed her husband's intention to keep LBJ as his running mate. Texas was still a critical state for John Kennedy, and it was in the throes of party factionalism and realignment that would have been made much worse if Johnson were dumped from the ticket. And many ask why President Kennedy would even go to Texas on a fence-mending mission if he secretly knew that he was going to be changing his re-election ticket, that is, dropping Johnson in a few months. Now look, Johnson arguably had the means and the motive and the opportunity to kill Kennedy. But so did dozens, if not hundreds, of other individuals and groups. And during the 5 decades since November 22, 1963, Lyndon Johnson's involvement is nothing more than conjecture, with no proof even of real smoke, much less fire. It's more like a misty fog generated by the need to find a larger-than-life villain to explain the great evil that ended a promising leader's life. Another area of controversy concerns the protection accorded to President Kennedy. This much is obvious. The federal agencies that were supposed to protect him failed at one, maybe the most fundamental responsibility. And then they tried to paper over their mistakes. The FBI destroyed evidence, and they assembled a self-serving report. The CIA withheld crucial information from the public, the press, and the Warren Commission for decades, and indeed may still be doing so. The Secret Service fell short in two ways. The agents designated to protect Kennedy's life were unable to accomplish the paramount mission of the Secret Service. And the administrative leadership of the Secret Service and its parent Treasury Department had not made an aggressive case for more agents. They'd not made the case for stricter standards to guard the president when he was outside the safe confines of the White House bubble. The individual agents are the least culpable, even though no group has blamed itself more. These men were shockingly overworked and overextended, almost beyond human endurance at times. The agents were also too few in number to do the job fully. They were kept too far away from the president to help in the kind of split-second attack that occurred in 1963. Their supervisors knew the dangers for years, yet nothing was done to stop a tragedy that was just waiting to happen. In combination, the Secret Service errors and the lack of better protection were fatal to John Kennedy. The service didn't even have Lee Harvey Oswald on any of its watch lists. Let's be clear, in the early 1960s, a person such as Oswald, despite having been a defector and having demonstrated hostility toward the United States and its leadership, could easily escape notice because he had not specifically telegraphed his intentions about hurting the president directly. In practice, the Secret Service depended heavily on regional law enforcement to provide them with the names of dangerous local residents. This was barely a safety net at all, and the Secret Service knew it, which is one of the reasons agents were always nervous during presidential trips outside Washington. As is too often the case, a monumental tragedy was needed to produce common sense reforms in presidential safety. After November 22nd, the Secret Service tightened protection in ways that should have been evident well before President Kennedy's murder. Today, it seems obvious that the president should not ride in an open convertible, nor should the motorcade route be broadcast and printed in newspapers as it was for 3 days prior to November 22, 1963, especially when tall buildings are all around and there are open windows everywhere. But to stop there misses the point entirely. When the route is released and publicized by any individual or group, it's then the responsibility of the Secret Service to make safe the path. The purpose of a motorcade is to enable a president to be seen. Why hadn't the agency provided in Dallas what in modern times would be considered a minimal level of security? Agents have claimed since that it was almost impossible to inspect buildings during presidential visits because of the shortage of time and manpower. This argues for more time and manpower, not a suspension of precautions. 50 years ago, the Secret Service already had precise procedures for inspecting buildings and making them secure in Washington during inaugural parades and events for visiting dignitaries. I've detailed this in the book, The Kennedy Half Century. Why were these requirements in effect only for special D.C. events? Why weren't they even more essential for road trips where the locales and threats might be less well-defined, less known in advance, especially when the president is sitting in an open car with nothing to stop bullets fired from any direction at him? Looking back, it's mind-boggling how naive and some would say lax the Secret Service was about presidential security in 1963. And it wasn't just the Secret Service. It was the presidential staff. Maybe it was all of us. We didn't believe it could happen here. It's happened so often in American history. We were forewarned. Even during Kennedy's term, there were so many threats. Presidents were permitted to ride in long motorcades past tall buildings with hundreds of open windows, any one of which could have hidden an assassin. This was a disaster waiting to happen, and it was no secret. Just about everyone in authority at the time knew it and worried about it. At the height of the Cold War, most Americans were instinctively anti-Castro, recognizing the dangers of a communist state just 90 miles from America's southernmost shore in Florida. The military and the CIA had begun extensive planning to oust Castro during the Eisenhower administration, and one of President Kennedy's first major decisions was to go forward with the U.S.-backed invasion of Cuban exiles in April 1961. After the disaster of the Bay of Pigs, a chastened JFK and his brother Robert became obsessed with deposing Castro. RFK created a major program of subterfuge and disruption known as Operation Mongoose to bring about Castro's downfall. The Kennedys authorized the CIA to do whatever was necessary to engineer a coup d'etat in Cuba. This led to serious assassination efforts, but also cartoonish schemes such as exploding cigars, since Castro was addicted to the tobacco leaf. The CIA even worked with mafia chieftains to arrange for Castro's demise. Political bedfellows were rarely stranger than in those days. But La Cosa Nostra, another name for the mafia, had lost many millions of dollars when the previous dictator of Cuba, Batista, had fallen to Castro. The Cuban expatriates in South Florida were willing partners. They wanted to retake Cuba. Meanwhile, despite his disillusionment with the Soviet Union and his return to the United States, Oswald made contact with the local Russian diaspora in Fort Worth, Texas. Oswald had personal reasons for doing so. His wife Marina was homesick, she didn't speak much English, and Lee was now used to Slavic people and their ways. Soon Oswald became friends with a peripatetic baron named George de Morenshield, whose life sounds like something out of a James Bond novel. De Morenshield's father, a wealthy Russian nobleman, managed to escape from a Soviet prison where he was sent after denouncing the Bolshevik Revolution. He then moved his family from Minsk to a posh estate in Poland, where George spent his youth. While still in his 20s, George left Europe to tour the United States and managed to become friendly with some of America's East Coast elites, including a family named Bouvier, whose daughter Jacqueline would one day become First Lady, and another family named Bush. George H.W. Bush's nephew roomed with de Morenshield at Phillips Academy. In the years that followed, de Morenshield became involved in intelligence operations. During World War II, he gathered information on pro-German activity in the United States for the French. There are allegations that he was spying for the Nazis at the same time, but these have never been proven. In 1942, he shared a house with a senior naval officer and a British intelligence agent in Washington, and he offered his services to the Office of Strategic Services. That's the predecessor to the CIA. But they turned him down because of the double agent rumor. During the 1950s, de Morenshield worked for the International Cooperation Administration, which was nothing more than a CIA-sponsored subsidiary for the Agency for International Development. In the early 1960s, while touring Central America and the Caribbean, he was photographed with the American ambassador to Costa Rica. In addition, de Morenshield and his wife visited Guatemala, which was a strategic launching site for CIA-backed Cuban exiles during Bay of Pigs. Some think the CIA, which at times almost certainly had some sort of relationship with de Morenshield, used him to make contact with Oswald. The Baron himself, however, denied the connection. He insisted that, quote, no government would be stupid enough to trust Lee with anything important, unquote. The full truth is elusive, but de Morenshield's acquaintance with Lee Oswald is curious. For someone dismissed as an obvious loser of little consequence, Lee Harvey Oswald kept popping up in the company of very well-connected individuals. Concluded that Ruby had impulsively killed Oswald in a fit of anger. But there were others who saw the potential for a plot with more sinister and far-reaching motives. Many mafia kingpins loathed the Kennedys, mainly because RFK went after organized crime with a vengeance once he became Attorney General. He raised the number of mob convictions from 35 in 1960 to 288 in 1963. Did Bobby Kennedy's aggressive tactics represent a betrayal of a deal between JFK's father, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., and the mob? Yes, it's not as outrageous as it sounds. Joseph Kennedy's, that is, Robert and John's father, had ties of some sort to organized crime, allegedly dating back to his days as a bootlegger during Prohibition, though others have challenged that suggestion. Shortly before the 1960 election, Joseph Kennedy was said to have promised Chicago mafiosa boss Sam Giancana access to the Oval Office in return for intervening with another mobster, Frank Costello, who had threatened to kill Joseph over a property dispute. The elder Kennedy was said to have made a deal with Giancana that if Giancana would protect him from Costello, he would see to it that Giancana had some access to the White House and the president. According to some published sources, Giancana agreed to the deal and convinced Costello to take Joe Kennedy off his hit list. Even before this incident, Giancana had apparently helped JFK by distributing cash to buy endorsements and votes during the critical West Virginia Democratic primary election in May 1960. The intermediary for the Kennedy-Giancana joint ventures was none other than singer Frank Sinatra. But the Kennedys turned on Giancana once they were in the White House, and Sinatra himself had to work hard to deflect the mobster's wrath at Sinatra on account of the Kennedys' unfaithfulness. The American public has been conditioned by the media and Hollywood to believe that the mafia is a well-oiled killing machine that can take down anyone. Author Mark North has accused FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, in effect, of being a silent accomplice to the assassination. In one of his books, Act of Treason, North argues that Hoover knew about a mafia plot to kill JFK, but says Hoover did nothing about it for two reasons. First, Hoover thought of Kennedy as indecisive and immoral because of Kennedy's extramarital affairs. And second, because JFK had made it known that he did not intend to keep Hoover in a second term. This second argument, especially in light of the first, is weak. While Kennedy would no doubt have preferred someone other than Hoover as FBI director, Hoover had cleverly accumulated evidence of JFK's infidelities and had made certain the Kennedys were aware of it. This provided him with an unusual form of job security. North claims that the overwhelming body of evidence points to the New Orleans mob boss Carlos Marcello as the person who masterminded the assassination. By the fall of 1962, Marcello was facing a federal indictment, possible deportation, and relentless attacks from Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department. Marcello reportedly believed that his problems would be solved by getting rid of President Kennedy and replacing him with President Johnson. It was common knowledge, North wrote, that LBJ had no interest in pursuing the mafia. FBI informers and pre-November 22nd eavesdropping had yielded a couple of clues that mob godfathers had drawn a bead on JFK. The assassination researcher Lamar Waldron has asserted, for example, that Marcello met with three men on the mobster's estate outside New Orleans in 1962 to lay out assassination plans. In the meeting, Waldron asserts that Marcello, quote, referred to President Kennedy as a dog, with his brother Robert being the tail. The dog, he said, will keep biting you if you only cut off its tail. In other words, Marcello believed he needed to kill JFK in order to neutralize Bobby. The House Committee on Assassinations' Robert Blakey also believes Marcello and Santo Trafficante, the mob don of Southern Florida, were the brains behind the Kennedy murder. In 1979, the same year the House Committee on Assassinations would issue an official government report asserting that Kennedy was killed by conspiracy, Marcello told an undercover FBI agent that he had known Oswald's uncle and knew that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for his uncle's gambling operation. Marcello and Trafficante made confessions shortly before they passed away. Marcello also told a fellow prison inmate that he had been introduced to Lee Oswald and had personally helped Jack Ruby get set up in the bar business. Whether every detail is true and accurate, two important points are clearly documented. The Kennedys had done a great deal to upset numerous mafia bosses, and the FBI had specific knowledge of a mafia interest in assassinating President Kennedy. There was both motive and means. The lack of swift and decisive action once these threats became known to the FBI is disturbing and raises legitimate questions about whether the FBI played a role, deliberate or not, in the murder of President Kennedy. The odds are they did not. You have to have specific evidence to make a charge this substantial and this damaging to a government agency or even to individuals within the FBI. Another example is a theory about the Secret Service supposedly being involved in the assassination unwittingly, accidentally. Some claim that one of the Secret Service guards in the follow-up car accidentally discharged his weapon after the first gunfire was heard, and that it was that bullet that pierced President Kennedy's skull and killed him. The assumption here is that no one saw it, or that those who did have kept quiet all these years to protect the Secret Service agent who is now deceased. It is far-fetched. It is extremely far-fetched. Any day now, given the number of theories about President Kennedy's assassination, I almost expect to see a headline, UFO killed Kennedy. The History Channel, given their predisposition toward ancient aliens, may even make it a feature story. There are certainly some witnesses there and many researchers who believe that at least one shot came from the so-called grassy knoll and behind the little picket fence, as you can see here, in the grassy knoll area. There's one photograph that may or may not show a policeman, so-called badge man, behind this particular picket fence. There's a puff of smoke. It may or may not be a puff of smoke, but it could be a puff of smoke. It could also be shadows from the sun onto the leaves of the tree. It's very difficult to tell because this is a Polaroid photo taken by Mary Moorman, and it's awfully difficult to make out very much. It is true that the people in Dealey Plaza, many of them ran up the grassy knoll. They were convinced that one or more of the shots came from the grassy knoll, while others thought it came from the school book depository building. It's difficult to know. It's difficult to say. And there were so many people with so many differing opinions and strong beliefs about the matter that it became difficult for anyone to sort out the truth. Conspiracy theorists across the political spectrum and around the world saw evidence of their enemy's handiwork in Dallas. The KGB quickly concluded that Kennedy had been killed, quote, by a circle of reactionary monopolists in league with pro-fascist groups, unquote. They thought these people who killed President Kennedy were doing so because the president supported civil rights and peace with Russia and higher taxes on oil profits. Khrushchev himself refused to believe, quote, that the U.S. security services were so inept as to have allowed a madman to kill the president, unquote. And he thought the Dallas police must have been involved in the murder. Fidel Castro held similar views. He implicated American ultra-reactionaries, whom the Cuban media described as power brokers upset over Kennedy's weak handling of Cuba. Similar themes rippled across the communist world. Communist propaganda organs in East Europe suggested that the rightists, in their impotence to reverse President Kennedy's liberal policies, had resorted to political terror to gain their ends, as one put it. A communist newspaper in Hanoi blamed U.S. financiers for the shooting. People living in other parts of the world put their own spin on November 22nd. Many sub-Saharan Africans thought that white racists had murdered Kennedy because of civil rights. Middle Eastern commentators viewed the JFK assassination as part of a Zionist plot. One Cairo newspaper noted that Oswald's killer was one Jack Ruberstein, a Jew, of course. He didn't quite get the name right. Right-wingers in nationalist China and also Latin America smelled a communist conspiracy, as did Herbert Philbrick, a rabid anti-communist and FBI counter-spy who later expounded his theories in a manuscript entitled The Strange Death of President Kennedy. In a matter of hours, JFK's assassination had become a reflection of each individual's ideology. People saw what they wanted to see in this Rorschach test, and they created narratives that reflected their personal prejudices and predilections. The rather odd legacy of abundant conspiracy theories concerning the assassination of JFK endures to this day. It shows no sign of abating, especially when the U.S. government continues to shield thousands of assassination-related documents from public inspection. Having said all this, though, it's important to stress one thing. You need proof. You need hard evidence to convict anyone of any crime, much less a terrible crime like the assassination of the President of the United States. It's one thing to believe that there's a possibility that a group or an individual participated in the assassination. All presidents have loads of enemies, and no doubt many would be happy were they removed from office. But having motive and having means and having opportunity does not mean that that individual or group actually participated in the assassination of President Kennedy. You have to have proof that would stand up in a courtroom. And most of the theories that are proposed about President Kennedy's assassination do not meet that simple but vital test.
I'm talking with Jerry Pippin about his show that's coming up this week, a special that he's doing where he comments on Bob Schieffer and some of his interviews on Face the Nation, and also on Dr. Larry Sabato, in which he has various events planned in Dallas, his book.
His book is A Kennedy Half Century. It's 600 pages. He talks about the various conspiracy theories, including the Cuban part of it, the Soviet part. But he starts off with LBJ. President Kennedy's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, made a list of possible characters that could be implicated in this, and Lyndon was at the top. And she also said, talking to President Kennedy, that he was going to put Lyndon off the ticket and bring in the governor from the Carolinas, Terry Stafford, who was a progressive type, but from the South, and that was would be part of the reason for doing this. However, though, other people, including Jackie Kennedy, said no, the president was going to keep Lyndon. In fact, Jackie Kennedy liked Lyndon. So there was a different of opinion there, and from other people, from what at least we were able to surmise, the reason for keeping Lyndon was very simple. It was called TEXAS, Texas. Jerry Pippin, what are your ideas?
I think you need to consider Mrs. Lincoln and where she's coming from. She was deeply involved in the Kennedy clan. And as we know, Bobby and even Ted, to a certain extent, had some animosity toward Lyndon Johnson. And there was really not much that Lyndon Johnson could do to change the perception that he was a wheeler dealer from Texas who would stop at nothing, including murder, to get rid of his mother and become president. Now, Larry Sabatol lays out the reasons why this theory, this hypothesis, falls apart, and he makes real good sense. So I urge people to listen to that show later in the week. It'll be available at jerrypippin.com plus various other places.
And also, you have other shows that have been done in the past with various people that have various takes on this, unique perspectives over the years. This is 50 years. But what has happened, you talk about Face the Nation, Bob Shoup, and also old man Jim Lehrer. And their perspective on this, I get the feeling that the perspective that's brought out, and of course, having Larry Sabatol as a ringmaster of this and his crystal ball, that's where things have went to. We have a similar model we call ours the Ouija board. But anyway, between Ouija boards, crystal balls, flying saucers, and you name it, here, what is basically happening is, and we look at the polling, and so does Sabatol. The 61% figure you gave was correct. That's today. Believe that somebody else was involved in this. So basically what they're trying to do is put a cap on 50 years and come out with the sort of magic bullet theory. Now, that was a theory of the prosecutor from Philadelphia, the Kansan. He had that, and the reason he had it was to solidify everything and explain away, because everybody knew at the time you could not shoot a bolt action, it was an Italian rifle, and fire as many bullets, it would have been utterly impossible. So the only way they could explain it was...
All Inspector deserves a fiction award for the Magic Bullet Award.
Well, he admitted that, but the whole idea was to have a general theory to explain how the bullet would have ended. Kennedy went through his back, bounced, and then hit Connally, and then the damage that it did to Connally. Because they couldn't have more than one bullet, the whole thing would have been out the door. So they had a magic bullet. And that theory has went on and on. And Sabatol talks about it in his course. I'd advise people to take the course. I think they have till like 6th of December to finish it up and to get credit for the thing. But nonetheless, with Dr. Sabatol's work, and his work is very important because he has written what CBS and the others have proclaimed the book. And we can only have one the book. We can't have 5 or 10 the books. So Sabatol has the book, the authoritative book to wrap all of this up. Now, that is kind of, you know, has fallen upon him to be the wrapper up of it, because obviously they couldn't use Sheep or Lair. Let me just give Jerry briefly here. He'll be in Dallas, Texas. you can RSVP, and I'll put this on our tonight's show. There'll be a panel discussion. That's on Wednesday, the 20th, at the Hyatt Regency Dallas. That's 300 Reunion Boulevard, Dallas, Texas. That'll be 6:30 to 8:30. It's open to the public. There'll be some panelists, Jim Bowles, Sid Davis, Wesley Frazier. He was one. And incidentally, we haven't talked enough about this. I'll let you talk in a minute. Mary Moreland, you remember her. Mary Moreland Kerpmer, and the Dr. Robert McClellan. It would be there. And then they'll have a second. They'll be viewing the 50th. It's a movie. And luncheonette at the Mongolian Hotel. That is 1401 Commerce Street in Dallas, Texas. That'll be from 11:30 to 2:30 on the day, the 22nd. And both events are free. And, of course, Dr. Saboteau will be there signing his books. The County Half Century, you can purchase those. And you have to send this to Glenn Crossman. He is at 434-243-3540. Again, that's 434-243-3540. And we'll put that information down there. So, Jerry, your comments.
Well, you know, far be it from me to brag on Professor Saboteau, but he did a good job in detail. Covering almost all the theories fairly objectively, don't you think?
Well, I think where Professor Saboteau starts out here, he was from Virginia, born in Virginia.
Yeah, we talked about him.
He was a Catholic.
Establishment book. And there's no doubt you can't take that away from him.
No, but, not at all.
Just like the LBJ piece we're getting ready to play, Saboteau's done his homework.
He has done his homework. He's been working for years on this with an army of researchers, literally an army. But the unfortunate problem is, even with his army of researchers, the record is not complete. The autopsy pictures, some of them are still in the National Archives. Much of the other information is there. I suppose when you hear from Mary Moorman, she was there that day. And in the part that you will hear on Jerry's show, Saboteau goes over a list of other people that were also in Dealey Plaza. So we have a lot of information, but obviously Bob Schieffer could not cover in his short panel discussion there. They had two panels, basically, within 20 minutes. That's the limitation of TV, and you can do a much better job of it. But still, with all the theories out there, all the research, the dictaphone belt, you talked about that in another episode, you can check that out on your site, and various other things that are 50 years old. They did as the best they could in getting access to some of these things, but some other things they never did get access to. And also on your site is an interview from the museum there in Dealey Plaza with Clint Hill and some other Secret Service agents down there. So there's a mountain of material that do make a little sense, but the sense that they make, at least in my opinion, they point to more than one assassin. You have Chief Curry talking about what he felt was the situation. But Saboteau points out in his book, basically, had they done the autopsy according to Texas law, and the body was there, many more things would have came up. But actually what happened was the body was moved, and that has never happened before. The president's clothes were thrown away, and that was before they got to Befesner. And the blood evidence in the limo, they literally brought out a bucket of water and they washed it away. So all the splatter and anything else in that limo was washed away. And you remember in those days, I don't know where the limo is, but in those days they didn't have a sophisticated test they had today. And they could have told them much about those bullets.
That's true. That's true.
So we're kind
of... And there's no wonder when you list the litany of things that are happening there, Boston Red, that some of us, like me, still believe that there was a cover-up, a conspiracy, and Lee Harvey Oswald was, at best, a player on the outer limits.
He was way on the outer limits. He said he was a patsy, and a perfect patsy. They had him cast as a, quote-unquote, the born loser. That's what Bob Schieffer says. An unlikely candidate. Well, he was an unlikely candidate, but in my opinion, he was a very likely candidate. Because if you wanted to portray somebody, the lone nut theory, he was unstable. He was this guy that failed at everything he did. But all of a sudden, he gets luck, and he's able to fire a bolt-action rifle and kill a president. Now, that's a miracle. He would have had to have been the best marksman in the world because they did bring in the best marksman they could find, and none of them were able to replicate that. That's why your friend there from Kansas, the district attorney at one time of Philadelphia, Mr. Arlen Specter, came up with the single bullet theory, the magic bullet, I guess you'd call it, a single bullet, magic bullet. And it was magic, but he didn't even believe it. He just said, well, we have to have some way of explaining what happened here. I mean, there are two men shot, and one bullet had to travel through the oven and literally come out of his body and hit the other guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Because
and it's amazing, it's crazy that people bought into that.
Well, they bought into it. They didn't at first. And of course, you know, you're much more into it than obviously I am because I was like Sabato. I think Sabato was a few years younger than me. But the point is, you were an adult at the time, and also, and I can even recall this, majority of the people then believed that was a conspiracy. They literally did. And it hadn't went down too much. I forget what the numbers were in 62, 64. But we'll say, for the sake of the argument, it was 80% or more. Well, it's 61% now. This is 50 years later.
I believe I read some place where it was 91%.
It may have been 91%.
In 65.
Okay. It probably was that high. But now you have to remember that when polling is done, and we went over some of that, is a lot of the polling is done with people younger than us, much younger than us. So they would have had no firsthand view of it, and they literally had live TV, something unheard of in the 60s. It went 24/7 from the time the TV came on until the time it went off at night. It was constantly this stuff playing. Started on the day of assassination, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then they did the funeral and all that, so there was constant information, and a lot of the information was live from Dallas, Texas, so they didn't have time to edit anything out or cover anything up. So, you know, all that information was out there for us to see, but it really was unfortunate. The things I did not know about, we'll wrap up this little preview, was the washing of the blood off the limits. Literally, they got a bucket of water and cleaned it all off. Now, why would they clean it off? The president would have obviously, he wasn't going to use it. Nobody was going to use it. They were going to take that car and put it back in those transport planes and send it on back to Washington. Well, that is very suspicious in itself. And even more suspicious was the secret.
And there were countless things that they did that were suspicious.
They were very suspicious.
And that's the reason... I still say that there was conspiracy. I mean, this is...
Well, it had to be
there's
because...
There's too many things that are coincidences, and that's just not possible.
Right, because the Secret Service agents were told, literally according to Sabato, and it's a movie out called Parkland that talks also about this, confronting the Texas authorities because the coroner of Dallas, Texas, said on the Texas law the body had to remain there. And Sabato adds the thing that they drew the guns. Now, I'm not sure if they did or they didn't. But you could understand that in Texas with the, you know, the Dallas police, the sheriff's people, the rangers, they would have had a lot more guns if they really did not want that body to leave. There would have been more bodies going back to Washington besides President Kennedy's. No doubt about that, and the body would have stayed there. But they did let the body go. It got to Bethesda. Man conducts the autopsy. Burns the thing, said he didn't want the ghouls to get hold of it. So in other words, that record disappeared immediately. The photos, some of those are still in the National Archive today. And a few of the witnesses are still alive. We'll hear from them, and we'll be reporting back on what Mary Moreland has to say. And some others are still alive that are giving different, you know, different stories of this. So the whole thing is out. I don't know. We won't be around, obviously, 50 years from now reporting this. But there's a possibility more evidence will come up. Who knows? I give you the last minute of this.
You're right. That's it's a never-ending question mark to all of the Kennedy assassination stories. And well, the question mark is, why did they do that? Who ordered that? Why? Who? You know, et cetera.
Well, it's all out there, and I suppose the one thing, mystery or whatever you want to call it out there is, there's still 50 years later, and not pointing fingers at any people here, but there's an attempt by, we'll call the powers to be, the Monopoly Network, especially them, to close this thing up as the nut Lee Harvey Oswald did it. The nut Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. He was an arrogant type, hung around police types. Well, yeah, because you have to understand the police types hung around his strip joint. So it was kind of a different situation. He was a born promoter, promoting, you know, many different kinds of things. And that's just, you know, one of the situations. I knew the guy that was actually his attorney and was his psychiatrist that actually gave him the tests, etc. And Ruby was not a bright man. And again, another patsy. So we got all these patsies out here and information that is really not as complete as probably what you had back there, because a lot of the people probably that you had, people that have interviewed and showed, are now dead. And the evidence
That's true.
Has
That's
disappeared.
True. And, you know, you're speaking of Jack Ruby. It appeared when he was in prison, it looks like he might talk. Suddenly he dies.
Well, that's true. He got a terminal cancer, and that was the end of Jack Ruby. And then also, now, one thing to note here, too, LBJ talked to Walter Cronkite about it, and he had some thoughts on it, and he himself did not think that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. But now, remember, it was a few days after the interview he had his massive heart attack. That was the LBJ.
Yeah, you got a point there, too.
So everybody that, you know, has come up with something, is no doubt President Johnson knew something about it because he was out there and he had a big ear, more in one way. But he would have heard who was doing what, when, where. Now, if he could have proved it, who knows? But evidently, when he was talking to Cronkite, there was this interview. I'll try to see if I can find some of that. But maybe we can throw it on your station, on your network. But the thing is, yeah, he talked about that, didn't go into details on it, and then he was dead. So all this, I guess the one thing, and we have to quit now, is just a bunch of dead ends. People died, and I forget how many people they said that were in Dealey Plaza that day that actually ended up dying very mysteriously, like falling off of steps and breaking their necks. In other words, it was a massacre going on out there, and all these people were going, and there was another woman Sabato talks about. She was going to lunch and had to go down the same stairwell into the Texas Book Depository that Lee Harvey Oswald would have had to take it. But you can guess, no Oswald. He was not in the stairwell, and he would have to come down that stairwell to leave. You know, there's just too many missing things here, and too many things like with the patrolman Tippett. The book on him was he was a fairly corrupt cop on the take, and he supposedly gets killed. But was Oswald there? A lot of people think he wasn't. So in other words, it's just a bunch of blind alleys, and you go down them, and that's how we'll end it.
Well, Boston Red, it's one of those rare occasions when we agree 100%.
Yes, we do indeed, Jerry. Good night. Thank you for being here. And we'll go forward with this until at least Friday.
It's been 50 years. It seems like just yesterday to all of us that were alive during that time. And it's something that really did change the psyche of America, and especially the psyche of American politics. Thanks for listening, everyone. Boston Red's been our producer. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thanks again. Good night.